Coming up on Windows Weekly with Paul Thrott and Mary Jo Foley. The Xbox One X is ready for pre-orders. Should you buy one? Mary Jo has a scoop on new Surface products, maybe in 2018. Windows Creator Update might be more reliable than previous versions. And Paul has a few choice words about iOS 11 in the enterprise. All that and more coming up on Windows Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Windows Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Windows Weekly with Paul Thrott and Mary Jo Foley, episode 536, recorded September 20th, 2017. Mary Jo loves the Xbox One X. This episode of Windows Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so that you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/windows. It's time for Windows Weekly, the show that organizes the most important Microsoft news way better than Focused Inbox. I'm Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, in for Leo Laporte, who is currently scouring the world for the secrets of the Illuminati. But of course, we've got the fort held down quite nicely here with Paul Thrott and Mary Jo Foley. Paul Thrott, of course, is the certifiably mad genius behind Thrott.com, purveyor of news, reviews, analysis for tech enthusiasts. Paul, it's great to work with you. How are you doing, my friend?
Okay, you guys can hear those sounds in my head, right? The banging, it's not just me.
I don't know what you're talking about. I think that's just you. Yeah, there's something happening in your house, right?
Yes, there is.
And it's a good thing. It's not the police.
There is someone from China is going to come out of the floor there, or we're going to get new lighting. Something is happening.
Lighting sounds to be, it's noisy. Your part of the world, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we'll be able to ride the sliders and make sure you can give us all the commentary, news, and analysis that we expect from Paul Thrott. Of course, Mary Jo Foley is here. She's the mastermind behind ZDNet's All About Microsoft blog. And together, they're here to give you all the news about Microsoft, like a fine, cheap boxed wine with that plastic spigot. Now, when I got the doc, when you sent me the doc this morning, I was a little surprised that we started with Mary Jo Foley's favorite topic in all of Microsoft, and that's the Xbox.
Oh, the Xbox.
The Xbox. But Paul, evidently there's some news about the Xbox. There's going to be a release soon. We should all be excited and pull out our checkbooks and get ready to buy.
Yes, and thank you for putting it that way, because that's exactly what you should be doing. So today, Microsoft opened up Xbox One X pre-orders for the second time. The first time was for the Project Scorpio Special Edition version of the console. It quickly sold out, and now what they're doing is making the standard version of the console available for pre-sale.
Right. The Project Scorpio, we've had the details about it for a while. I don't know. You can't really call it a super console. The specs are impressive. It does look nice, but we are sort of in the plateau stage of the gaming console where we've got enough computing power. We actually could still use the previous generations of console. So this is more of an entertainment device rather than a video game machine.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, honestly, it's being marketed more for video games because the entertainment capabilities that are possible on the X are actually still available in the Xbox One S, which is a lot less expensive. But yeah, I mean, the way things are right now, and I've actually been testing a gaming PC recently as well, which has, you know, dual graphics, you know, really high-end system, 4.2 gigahertz processor, all this kind of stuff. It's impressive, right? I mean, G-Sync and 144-hertz, you know, display and everything, it's neat. But there's something nice about a console. You just kind of click the button, the thing comes on, you start the game, it plays. You don't have to, you know, think about settings, or if I turned off the mist in this game, will this make the frame rate one, you know, frame second, you know, faster per second or whatever? And I think there'll always be a place for that kind of thing. And I think the final frontier for console gaming is getting something that approaches what's possible on high-end PCs. And so obviously, yes, you'll always be able to get a better graphical experience, especially on a PC, but for a lot of money and for a lot of work. And the other thing that the Xbox One X does that I think is really important is it fits really nicely within a spectrum of offerings from Microsoft that now comprise their Xbox strategy, right? That Xbox is not just a console that basically sits still from a capabilities perspective for 8 years. It's a family of devices where the capabilities improve over time, but you never lose backwards compatibility. And they've really taken it to kind of an extreme, because not only does this stuff work in some cases on Windows 10 PCs as well, but the backwards compatibility stuff works soon all the way back to the original Xbox. And so not every single game, but a lot of the best games on Xbox 360 already available on Xbox One, and soon the original Xbox as well. So it's not a new thing per se, like a new incompatible, you know, completely different thing, but it is definitely a big step up, and I think is a really nice glimpse at the future of console gaming. I think this is where things are headed, and I think Sony is doing something pretty similar as well.
Right. We've also heard that there's going to be 130 plus titles available for the enhanced version, which is nice, and especially if you can go backwards and get all of the classic titles, it makes it far more compelling. Now Mary Jo, I understand that the console world, the gaming world, is not your beat. However, there definitely is an angle here in that if you go back to, say, the Microsoft Device Nights that they had last year, one of their big selling points was this idea of Xbox everywhere, live everywhere. It's on the PC, it's on the console, it's on your Surface. You carry it with you. When they had a phone, there was some extensibility to a phone.
Yeah.
And the line between console device, video game machine, and enterprise powerhouse really gets blurry when you start talking about a cloud-based service that just happens to also play video games. Do you see this being more of an appeal than just something for gamers?
No.
Oh, okay. I tried. I really tried.
Next question, Bob.
Everyone jokes on Windows Weekly and outside of Windows Weekly how much I don't care about gaming. But I will tell you this. I do care about it to the extent that you just mentioned it, Padre, which is it's a service, right? And the cloud services are Microsoft's future. So I do care about Xbox Live as a service that Microsoft is looking at to monetize Windows. So I don't totally not care, but I just personally don't care. But I understand the value to the company about gaming overall and why they continue to invest in gaming. So I do get it, but just not a personal appeal thing. Even Cuphead, guys, sorry. I know people were thinking that was what was going to win me over, but now, I think Cuphead I'm destined not to be a gamer.
Awesome.
Now, Paul, I have you pre-ordered? Because I actually did pre-order. Yeah. So I'm on my Steam account, I'm ready for Cuphead to drop.
Right.
What is it about Cuphead that captured the imagination of so many people? And Mary Jo Foley, you've already expressed that it's not going to win you over, but some people are saying that might be the game that finally appreciate, gets me to begin.
I think she appreciates the awesomeness of it, right? That
I do. The graphics.
There's something universal.
Yeah. Yeah, when we first saw Cuphead, when was that, like 3 years ago, two, three years ago? I was like, okay, now there's a game that looks sort of fun for somebody like me who doesn't care about first-person shooters, right? Like, okay, that's cool.
You know what it is? Today's kids are missing out on something that I think was actually really important and multi-generational before, which was that when I grew up, when you grew up, and for another half generation and a few generations before that, we all actually had these shared experiences on TV that were classic cartoons and movies from the past in some cases, right? And so my kids today, my kids are actually old enough that they sort of hit on the end of this, but really young kids today don't have that experience where you get up on Saturday morning and the Warner Brother cartoons are just on TV and there's little educational things between them. And it's like it's a morning and it's something you look forward to and it's great. Some years ago, I showed my kids a bunch of Roadrunner, Wile E. Coyote cartoons, hoping to God that they would just love this like I did. And they did. They immediately fell in love with this thing. And I think the kind of it's like a 1930s cartoon aesthetic that's in Cuphead is not, you don't have to have been around then. None of us were. But because that stuff kind of persisted, we all kind of appreciate it and understand it immediately. That whole thing where like the characters are kind of, you know, bouncing up and down like Steamboat Willie did, or like Mickey Mouse did in Steamboat Willie, I think is just it's neat. And I think even, you know, people today with their lack of attention span and lack of appreciation of things that came in the past, I think even they would look at this and just because it's kind of frenetic and fast moving, and unique looking. I mean, to them, maybe they've never seen anything that looks like this, but I just think there's a universal quality to this game that's really hard to explain. And unless you see it, and then you're just like, yep, yeah, it's just neat looking.
I remember
I've seen people. Is it hard to play though? Like I asked this last week too, because I've seen a couple people who've had a chance to do hands on with it saying it's pretty hard.
So I have a theory about that. I didn't think it was hard. It's a platformer, right? Okay. So, I think the problem is it is universally attractive to people. So people who don't play a lot of games pick this thing up and they're like, oh, this is kind of hard. You know, it's like, yeah, you've been using a fidget spinner for the past 6 months. Maybe you should do something slightly more complicated. You know, manipulate an object in real time and you know, maybe this will be good for your hand-eye coordination. I don't know.
Right. See how it goes.
Yeah. Just a thought.
Yeah. Right. There's a famous video right now on YouTube of, his name flees me, but he played Cuphead and got
Dean Takahashi.
Dean, right. He got maybe, 60% through the level after 30 minutes. And people the comments are horrible. People are calling him an idiot. They say he deliberately screwed up the experience.
Usually on YouTube, the comments are great.
I know, right? Yeah. It's not what I expect.
Yeah, but constructive. I
mean, these are particularly bileful because they're saying he's not a real video game journalist, even though he's been covering this longer than anyone else I know.
Yeah, what are your credentials exactly?
Yeah.
Oh, well.
No. And yes, it is difficult, but it's especially difficult for those who maybe haven't picked up a platformer in a while. A platformer is FPS. That's right.
No, it's a different kind of game. And this harkens back to, you know, for me as an Amiga guy, like the Shadow of the Beast type games, or if you came from the UK, there was a whole, not a family, but just a whole group of games that came out of there that were platform side-scrollers. That was just what the games were back then. The original Duke Nukem games, by the way, were side-scrolling 2D platformers. That's what they were. And then the third one came and it went first person. But yeah, this is what video. Well, they didn't have this kind of awesome graphics. Obviously, the effect here is so beautiful, but the game style, the play style, is classic platformer.
Now, this game almost ended up in development hell because I saw it first in 2015, and I loved it. I loved the aesthetic. Like you, the very first thing I thought of was, oh, that's Steamboat Willie. That's the animation style. But since then, they actually rewrote the entire game. And details are starting to emerge about why that happened. But essentially, you have a bunch of people who were incredibly passionate about the project, and it just didn't feel I admire that, even though most of the 99% of the time when you have a team like that, that essentially means the project will never be released. I'm happy to play.
Yeah, when a couple of Christmases kind of came and went and this didn't show up, the thought was, oh, that's too bad. That looked cool.
Yeah.
Because that happens to a lot of games, unfortunately. So yeah, I think it's fantastic that this thing is finally happening.
Right. Well, Mary Jo, I know you're not into it. However, the next time you come to the Brick House, we will have multiple machines here, probably a Surface, a desktop, and a console, all with Cuphead. Would you be willing to go a couple of rounds of co-op with me?
Sure, you'll have to show me how to play, but I would try it.
Yeah, I mean, it's cartoon violence, so it'll be fine. Yeah. Yeah, it'll be great. Yeah. It'll be great.
It's no violence like cartoon violence, let me tell you.
Yeah. Now, Paul, one other bit on this, and that is Minecraft. Yep. We've been promised this idea of the Better Together update. It's going to fix everything. It's going to make the gaming experience wonderful. What exactly is it? I'm not a Minecrafter, so I'm not really in that world.
Yeah, but you know what? You could be, because this is actually kind of a big deal. So the problem with Minecraft to date is that there were all these different versions of it across different platforms, and they're not compatible with each other for the most part. And so if you had Minecraft, you know, Pocket Minecraft or what it was called on Android, and you had Minecraft for Windows 10, or you had the old Java version of Minecraft, you couldn't play together with other people unless they were on that same exact platform.
Right.
And so the Better Together update is going to eliminate a lot of these special versions of Minecraft across consoles. It's just going to be Minecraft for the most part, and you'll be able to cross play. And it's apparently out today. I'm not seeing it yet, but the idea is if you have it on Xbox One, Windows 10 PC, Android, iOS, or VR, and I'm not sure what they mean by VR exactly, but I assume what that means is Oculus Rift and HTC Vive. I'm not actually 100% sure on that one. And sometime this winter, also the Nintendo Switch, The games will be aligned for the most part from a functional perspective, because that was the other issue. There are lots of different features that, the matrix of what was available in each version of Minecraft was impossible for any human being to understand. It was like trying to understand Azure. So they're bringing these things together functionally and then enabling crossplay, right? Minecraft is just one of those kind of beautiful things. Like, I don't know if Microsoft ever, if Minecraft ever becomes like a great investment for Microsoft or whatever. But the one thing I will say is, on the flip side, there was a lot of worry that when Microsoft took over Minecraft that they were going to kill it, and not it on purpose, but just by being Microsoft. I got to say, and I think almost anyone would agree with this, Microsoft has been a great steward for this game. And they've done well by it. They've done well by the community. And this thing is maybe the ultimate expression of this. It has to be the number one request across the board for, like, how could we possibly make Minecraft better? Make it work everywhere and make it work together, So this is huge.
I'm actually really interested to see how they handicap the different platforms, because we all know one of the big challenges wasn't making, say, an Xbox work with a PC, because that's all back end. That's just player data. It's the fact that the experience is different if you're using a mouse versus a joystick, a controller pad, a Surface, or a VR, now that they're going to have VR headsets. So you have to do something to sort of even the playing field so it doesn't become, you want to actually do well, you need to play on a PC.
So I think Minecraft is actually ideal for that kind of thing. If you think about a shooter, a PlayerUnknown's Battleground or whatever. So that thing comes to the console, and you're going to have a bunch of guys on the PC running around in that world with their mouse and keyboard making lightning quick moves and everything. They're going to wipe out people on a controller. This is nothing you can do about that. But that kind of game relies on that kind of quick action, and it's a different kind of experience. And I think that's problematic. You could enable shooters across consoles, right? And that would be fine. This kind of game, though, because mostly what it is not quick action, it's mostly really just, especially when you think about the kind of co-op possibilities, it's usually two or more people doing something together. They're working together. And it's a different kind of experience. You're building things. You're not destroying things, right? Although, obviously, destroying things could be part of it. But I think Minecraft is maybe somewhat uniquely well-suited to this kind of thing, which is part of the reason it's so great.
Right.
I think there are going to be platform differences, right? I think there'll be certain features or whatever it is that might be available only on PC and Xbox, or only on this and that, or whatever it might be. I think those things get ironed out over time. But whatever, they're making this happen. Like, they've taken the step. They're not just doing it like piecemeal. Like, this is happening today.
This is Microsoft. The way I see it, this is Microsoft's Apple II. This is their getting into the schools. It's a long game. Yeah. But because Minecraft is enduring, we've got Squish in the chat room who's making a very good point, which is his 7-year-old makes amazing things in Minecraft. Mm-hmm. And it only takes a parent one time to see that and go, this is different.
Yep. I've told the story in the podcast. I'm just going to tell it today because I feel like you maybe haven't heard this. But years ago, I heard some strange music coming from upstairs, and I went upstairs to see what it was. It was my son's bedroom. And so he's playing something on his Xbox 360 at the time. And I kind of looked at it, and it's like, these 8-bit graphics, and it looks terrible compared to what an Xbox 360 game would look at the time. And I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm playing Minecraft." I'm like, "Oh," and you could tell he was building something. I said, "Are you like making a level for a game so you can run around and shoot it and stuff?" He says, "No, this is what you do. You build things." And I'm like, "Okay." And then just at that moment, it was like a cloaked figure kind of floated by in space. And I said, "What was that?" And he said, "Oh, it's my cousin Harrison." I said, "Okay, as you were." And I just walked away, and I'm like, this is unbelievable. Yeah. Here's a kid who might normally have been sitting there, trigger shooting aliens or in Halo or playing some Call of Duty game, and he's building things with his cousin virtually, and I'm like, this is beautiful, The other thing that I think is really relevant to this discussion is Mary Jo and I, and I would say myself in particular, have been kind of down on Microsoft's future in the client and talking about how, the world has changed and we've moved on and these things are happening and this is happening. And one of the big problems that I see for Microsoft and the client is this kind of lack of enthusiasm on the part of the user base, that the PC market is kind of dwindling. Mm-hmm. The people who are on PC aren't particularly enthusiastic about the platform. They're not going to sit there and shop in a store and buy stuff. They don't care about that stuff. They look at a PC as work. They get in, they get out. So we've talked about that kind of thing a lot. What's really cool about Minecraft is that this is their version of what Apple fans have or what Apple has with its fans, you have an enthusiastic user base. You have a user base that starts when they're young, of kids who want to play this thing. You know, they go into, imagine if you could go into school and this was one of the things you could do, right? That's a day you look forward to. Mm-hmm. It's a thing that could get kids into programming at a really early age and turn them into developers later in life. This is one of the few things that Microsoft has today that is creating enthusiasm from a growing community of people on the client. It's kind of incredible when you think about it from that perspective.
Right. And it has a great tie-in with what they're doing with mixed reality and the HoloLens, right? Like it kind of just, it's when they first bought Minecraft, people were like, what? And then you're like, wait, it actually fits in really well in multiple places in Microsoft's product line, right? So
it might be the only thing that makes mixed reality look good. It might be the only thing that will ever be truly successful on VR, AR, mixed reality in the short term.
It's the killer app. They have the killer app. But I remember that when they made the announcement that Microsoft was going to buy Minecraft. As Paul said, you had the Minecraft faithful who said, well, that's the death of Minecraft. Microsoft's going to destroy it. And then you had the enterprise faithful who are saying, why would you spend that much money on building blocks? That makes no sense.
Yeah.
It makes sense now when you see the strategy. Yeah. It's everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's all across Microsoft's platform. And you're right. It does encourage loyalty to the client.
Right. Yeah. So if you think about it, when if we go back like half a generation, the PC industry is running strong and kids are coming up through school. And like one of the things that's important to learn is how to use a computer. Here's a mouse. Here's how it works. Keyboard. Here's how you interact with the screen. You want to learn Word and PowerPoint and Excel. And these are the skills you take into college and into the workforce. These days, you know, that stuff isn't kind of not happening anymore. And that's a big problem for Microsoft in the future. But it should be encouraging to anybody, for people to know that when people think of Microsoft who are young, who are kids, they're not thinking GE, IBM, stodgy old company. They're thinking, oh, Minecraft, I love that company. Mm-hmm. And that's super important. And I, you know, I said earlier, like, I don't know if they'll ever make up their investment in Mojang or whatever, whatever billions or whatever they spent on it. Like, I don't know that they'll ever make that money back. But the stuff they get out of Minecraft that is this stuff, you can't put a dollar tag on it, a price tag on it. It's enormous.
Well, I mean, they could have bought Minecraft or they could have bought Nokia. So, I mean, both of those. I forgot.
Listen, even the best batter only hits about 300. So, not everyone's going to be a home run.
Yeah, 500 on super multi-billion-dollar deals. Actually, that's not bad. Although that ride down,
I'm not sure they're actually doing 500. But I see what you're saying.
Now, Mary Jo, we can get you into gaming for this particular story because I think we've seen a little glimpse into the Satya Nadella Services First vision for Microsoft, in that when you look at the senior leadership team, they've added a new position, and that position comes from the gaming world.
I know. This was a kind of a surprise announcement this week, at least surprising to me. So the senior leadership team at Microsoft, known as the SLT, this is like the inner circle, right? These are the people who work with Satya Nadella, and they're like the ones crafting Microsoft's future and their strategy and all.
You said crafting.
Crafting. So this week they added Phil Spencer, who is Mr. Xbox, to the senior leadership team. They promoted him to executive vice president of gaming at Microsoft. So that is a very significant thing, to put him on the senior leadership team. He's in charge of gaming across the company, across all devices and services. The gaming org is still part of Windows and devices, but this like really elevates the prominence of gaming as part of Microsoft's overall strategy. And like Padre said earlier, a lot of enterprise people were kind of like, come on, Microsoft's an enterprise company. Just focus on the enterprise. I've said that as well. But no, they are going to continue to make gaming a key part of their strategy. And this move this week shows how serious they are about staying in the gaming space, looking to gaming as a way to monetize Windows. As I said previously, games are one of the biggest categories of apps on mobile devices and other devices right now. So Microsoft's in it for the long haul. They're not getting out. There was a time not that long ago, there was a rumor that they're going to like split off Xbox or sell Xbox. So I think this is probably not going to happen.
Right. Now, so let me.
I mentioned in the notes I have a theory, but I just have a, if you don't mind, I have a question for Mary Jo, because my theory is based on the answer to this question. You probably have a better idea of what makes up Microsoft's star chamber, or as you called it, the senior leadership team. What are there any other examples of people on the senior leadership team who are not at that top level of corporate vice president or vice president or whatever? In other words, you mentioned, for example, that Phil is works under Terry.
Yep.
Is there a lot of that in the senior leadership team, or is this fairly unique?
So I'm looking at the people who are in the senior leadership team right now. You've got people like Chris Kapp, Chris Cappicella, you know, who we've had on Windows Weekly, chief marketing officer. You've got the head of global sales for Microsoft, Jean-Philippe Courtois. You've got Peggy Johnson, who's the VP of business development, Amy Hood, the CFO. There aren't a lot of like people who are not like at the highest echelons of Microsoft who are on the senior leadership
team. That's what makes this very interesting, right?
Yeah.
I'm not saying he's the only one.
No.
But he kind of is the only one who, right? Who works for someone else on the senior leadership team, who's not Satya Nadella, I guess.
I think the only other one I would point at, Rajesh Jha, he's the executive vice president of office products.
Okay, that's true.
He might be kind of equivalent. And then the CTO from LinkedIn, Kevin Scott, is also now on the senior leadership team too. So there are some exceptions where they're not like Scott Guthrie, you know, and those kind of folks. But it is very unusual and significant. Yes.
Yeah, a lot of C-level executive vice presidents, and then you got this guy from Xbox in there.
Yeah.
And, you know, he probably walks in there in his jeans and his T-shirt, and he's got his baseball cap on backwards and looking at his phone. But, you know, I wonder if this doesn't signal something, you know, that I've always felt like the more personal computing part of Microsoft was a dumping ground for the stuff that didn't fit neatly into the rest of the company, you know, that the other major business units at Microsoft make some sort of thematic sense, and that more personal computing in some ways does not. And I understand how Xbox and Windows 10 are, you know, related from some technological perspective and actually even from a marketing perspective. But I'm not really 100% sure that having the same guy in charge of both makes sense, right? That Xbox should fall under Windows, if that makes sense.
Right. And so here's an interesting thing. Like Panos Panay, who heads up all devices, is not on the senior leadership team.
Right. And he's been there doing his thing for a longer time than
Phil Spencer. I don't know if he's been there longer, but
Well, at that level, I mean, of company.
In fact, this is actually a funny coincidence while we're doing the show. Phil Spencer just tweeted, "Great to have Panos Panay and team in the factory checking out the Xbox One X coming off the line." And he has a picture of Panos and Stevie Batish and some other people from the devices group in his on his Twitter post in China as this stuff is rolling off the line. So, pretty cool.
Well, I mean, I'm wondering now if Xbox doesn't maybe move sideways or if this, at the very least, I would say, I think you kind of implied this. I mean, it signals a new importance for gaming at the company. It's very interesting.
The other announcement that went hand in hand with this, and this could make you say, okay, this is also elevating the importance of the Windows and Devices group in Microsoft's hierarchy overall, is they took Brad Anderson's team, which was running the enterprise mobility and security stuff, and they moved them under Terry in Windows this week. So that, you know, a lot, I always see people going, you know, WDG, the Windows and Devices group, it's kind of on the downswing. And we've even said that on the show, like, it's, you know, Microsoft's all about the cloud. But the reason they moved Brad Anderson's org over there is because Microsoft is doing more and more things like this Microsoft 365 bundle that they announced at Build. And enterprise mobility and security is a key piece of that. So it makes sense to have that part of the company aligned in there more with Windows, just like they've got, you know, Phil Spencer's gaming org.
That's actually kind of interesting. This is more your kind of a story, but one of the things I became aware of, I think it was at the partner conference, which is called what now?
Inspire.
God, I hate these names.
Ignite. So, which one?
No, not Ignite.
Okay. Inspire.
So, anyway, I was talking to Soros from Microsoft, and basically, you know, he was telling me that the the addition of Windows 10 to Microsoft 365 was kind of last minute, and it came about because someone from Terry's org had found that they were doing this and said, what the hell, mm-hmm. we need to be part of this. And mm-hmm. so they went and, you know, reached out to those guys, and of course the people, basically Office 365 part of the company, mm-hmm. said, you know, we don't understand what you're bringing to the table here exactly. And they said, we have Windows 10. They said, right, but we're doing all these unique things. What's unique about, what can you do that's unique that isn't already mm-hmm. in Windows 10? Mm-hmm. The answer was nothing. But the thing is, you get this kind of special version of Windows 10, don't you now? It's called Windows 10 Business, right? And so they yeah. kind of made it up as they went along, right? Well, here's a little bit of politics for you. That group is now under Terry, yep. right? And so I've, you know, we've met Terry. He's a great guy. He doesn't seem like this kind of political animal to me, but I mean, obviously he's doing something right, you know, from a yep. career perspective. How he yep. got in charge of Windows, how he got in charge of more personal computing, how he got these parts of the company like Xbox first and now this under him is very interesting, because these guys that now work for him did not want his product as part of that offering mm. originally. Now they work for him.
Yeah, I think it made a ton of sense to put all those things into that one bundle. And I think yeah. that's kind of the future of Microsoft. Like, you know, Office 365, yeah, that's really key. Enterprise mobility yeah. and security, really key. But when you combine all three things across the three Microsoft divisions, and then you have it as a single bundle that, you know, partners can sell, customers can buy and subscribe to, it's a pretty big deal.
Yeah. No, I think anyone yeah. would agree with that. But it's interesting that they kind of invented a new version of Windows that only occurs in that thing. Mm, it was almost right. like the deal was, look, yeah. we'll put you in here, but you got to be something special. So they said, well, let's just call it Windows 10 Business.
I
really think it's that goofy.
I mean, this is the breaking down of the siloization at Microsoft that we've been looking forward to. And mm-hmm. yeah, when you break down silos, you're going to get some mismatches, because each of these was in its own bin for a reason, because yeah. it had something unique that other mm-hmm. divisions didn't do. And as we do this,
all right, but
it's more important that you put it under a person who can actually shepherd it, right?
Here's the thing. I think you can make a great case that that part of the company, meaning the device, it's basically what EMS, device management stuff, you know, Windows management should be under Windows, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I think mm-hmm. that makes sense. And so Brad yeah. and those guys coming over to Terry's org makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Those guys being in the same org with Xbox doesn't make any sense to me. And I think you could make the argument that though, like, Windows plus management makes more sense than Windows plus management plus Xbox. Mm. And this is going back to my theory. I wonder if it doesn't make sense for Microsoft to break off consumer, essentially,
yeah.
From what is now Terry's org. That what Terry's org maybe becomes, and maybe what it should become, mm-hmm. is what Windows is really, which is this kind of business solution where it's really popular with in commercial. And that mm-hmm. what this thing really is like commercial client and client management.
Mm-hmm. They've fought that for forever, right? Like, they keep saying, yeah. you know, that it's impossible to split your work life and your personal life. And as we go forward, it's getting even harder to split it. So why should we have consumer be separate? Like, consumer and commercial, they're one. I never bought that myself. I didn't really buy into that argument. I think they could split it. But they have fought very strongly against the idea of doing that.
I think we're past the time for this. But years ago, I had kind of argued that you have this thing called Windows, and when Windows could be the base of stuff, and that mm-hmm. you have a group that works on the business end that makes a business version of Windows. It's all business, if you will. And then they have mm-hmm. a consumer group that puts fun stuff into it. And the thing that makes Windows, well, no, I mean, stuff you might want to use at home, you know?
Yeah.
You know, nobody at work needs like a Groove music player built into the OS. Like, it, mm-hmm. it doesn't have to be there. I still think that
they're struggling with that, right? Like, Fall Creators yeah. Update is a great example of struggling with the split yes. between consumer and business.
Listen, I'm being recommended an app called Cooking Fever today in Windows 10. There's no way that should be on a work computer. It makes no sense. But this is the problem. So you were saying, you know, they've struggled with this. How do we divide stuff yeah. up? But I would point at more personal computing today and say, this is arbitrary as it is. You can mm-hmm. divide this up however you want. I mean, mm-hmm. there's all different ways that make sense or don't make sense. And nothing will ever make sense 100% because, right. you know, like I said, if you pull out Xbox, for example, and make it its own organization or whatever, you know, someone will point out, well, yeah, but the Xbox One is based on Windows 10 and those guys have to work yep. hand in hand or whatever. And the answer to that is yes, of course they do. But That doesn't mean they have to be in the same business unit, you know?
Yeah.
Mary Jo, can I ask you, mm-hmm. what do people on the SLT, on the senior leadership team, get? I mean, you get to whisper in Satya Nadella's ear, but really, how does that actually work?
Well, I know they have a regularly scheduled meeting. I think it's something like Friday at 8 a.m. every week, where all of them are there, and they talk about, you know, what they need to be prioritizing and important things for the company as a whole to be working on. So it's a way to bring the leaders of important parts of the company together so that they can have a more unified strategy, is the way I think about it and understand it. You know, like otherwise, Satya's having a meeting over here with Windows and Devices, then he's having a different meeting with the Office group, and then he's having a different meeting with HR, you know. And instead, when Microsoft did the whole one Microsoft reorg, the idea was, you know, we're one company, even though we have a lot of diverse businesses, and we should be strategizing and talking and thinking together about how we can be stronger as a whole instead of all these loosely coupled parts. So the idea is, this is like the brain trust, right? And they're trying to help craft a strategy for the company that works across all the various parts of the business and makes sense for the company as a whole.
Right. And this goes to Paul's point about having people at the table who actually work for other people at the table. When they're at this meeting, is it sort of Knights of the Round Table? Everyone has an equal seat. You don't always have to be looking over your shoulder to see if your boss is getting upset at what you're saying. I mean, what kind of culture have they built?
Terry could disagree with.
Right. Exactly.
I'm sorry.
Right.
So I've never been invited for some odd reason to the SLT meeting at Friday at 8 a.m. But, but you know, I think we're about to see Satya Nadella's new book come out next week, right? It's his book about how he's tried to change Microsoft as he's been the CEO and things he's done. One of the things he talks about a lot in general, and I would assume you would talk about it in the book too, is the idea of a learn-it-all mentality instead of a know-it-all mentality. So I think since he has been the CEO, he's tried to foster more of a cooperative environment than used to be the case when Steve Ballmer or Bill Gates were the CEOs. So I would imagine it would be a fairly friendly meeting. I'm sure there's a lot of disagreement, but I wouldn't think it would be like the shouting matches of former days. Just a guess.
Right. No banging on the table.
Yeah, right. No tables being thrown, no chairs being thrown, no people being thrown. I think it would be, you know.
No holes in the wall.
A little more friendly. Yeah.
No iPhones being crushed.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
Exactly.
A kinder, gentler senior leadership team.
I would guess. You know, and I'm sure there's still a lot of very strong argument and disagreement about, you know, hey, we should do this with Nokia. Hey, we shouldn't do this with Nokia. You know, like I'm sure not everyone's on the exact same page, but I think my feeling from having talked to Satya Nadella is he's trying to foster more of a work together kind of environment than one where teams are pitted against each other and may the best team win.
Right, right. And actually, I've heard from a source that every Friday morning at 8 o'clock they start with a round of Minecraft, which will be sitting over the Cuphead in about 2 weeks.
Which now they can do on the platform of their choice.
They get to choose what they want to play on.
Yep.
Well, Mary Jo, when we come back, you've got a scoop on some news about the service. So if people are waiting for the next announcements, I think you could probably satiate their service lust. We'll get to that in just a bit. But first, let's go ahead and take a break to thank a sponsor of this episode of Windows Weekly. Now, let me ask you a question. Do you like the mortgage process? The way it is right now. I mean, the fun of being able to go into a bank and talking to a bank manager or a loan officer, of dragging in all your receipts, of trying to convince them that you are worthy of a loan from their financial institution. Well, if you're like most people or any people, then the answer is no. Of course you don't like that. It's a nightmare scenario because it's based in finances from 2, 3, 4, 5 decades ago. What we need is a solution for mortgages that is up to date, that lives in the digital world. What we need is Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Now, this episode of Windows Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. The mortgage experience wasn't keeping up with the times. We all know that. It was dated, and it needed a client-focused technological revolution. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence that you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Now, it's simple. It allows you to fully understand all the details and be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's also convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at a touch of a button. No more dragging in bankers' boxes filled with receipts and old pay stubs. It's powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds. And what that means is that based on your income, your assets, and your credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of your home loan options for which you qualify and find the one that's just right for you. Now, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, you can apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/windows. That's rocketmortgage.com/windows. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of Windows Weekly. Okay, Mary Jo, I'm looking for a Surface. I need a Surface. I need to. I've got this jonesing for some Surface news. What do you got for me?
Okay. So we know a little more about Microsoft's fall event schedule as of this week. They've shared some things with us. October 3rd. Well, let's start with Ignite. Ignite's next week. We don't think there's going to be any new Surface news there. October 3rd in San Francisco, Microsoft's having a mixed reality event where they're going to be showing off their whole end-to-end mixed reality strategy, from the HoloLens to PCs with the holographic environment to headsets that can work with these PCs and participate in a mixed reality scenario. I don't think there's going to be any new Surface hardware at that event on October 3rd. But we've been hearing that at the very end of October, Microsoft's having an event in London called Future Decoded. And we believe at that event, where Panos Panay will be one of the speakers, that there will be a Surface announcement there. My sources are now saying it's going to be a very low-key event for them there, and likely Surface Pro with LTE will be what they take the wraps off of there. They already said they would have this kind of a version of the Surface Pro at some point, but they didn't say when. And that may be all that ships this fall from the Surface Group. There may be, you know, we also know, as we mentioned earlier in the show, Xbox One X coming out November 7th. But in terms of new Surface hardware, that may be it. A lot of us have been thinking there could be a new Surface Book out this year. And I'm hearing if Microsoft does announce a successor to the Surface Book, it likely will not ship until next year. Like Q1 of next year. So it's going to be, you know, compared to the past 2 years when they had fall Surface events, it's going to be a fairly low-key fall launch for the Surface team, is what the scuttlebutt is. So if you were holding out for the new Surface Book, I don't think it's going to ship this year.
There was a UK site today that had put up the Surface Pro with LTE for pre-order. Microsoft.
Really?
Yeah, I think it might have been a mistake. Not that it's not coming, but I don't think they were supposed to do it this early.
Yeah, probably not.
But we are expecting that device sometime this year. Obviously, that's a minor thing. But there's some stuff I think a lot of people have been thinking about. You know, for example, the next Surface Book, and whether they even do a next Surface Book, the next Surface Studio, and what the timing for that might be. A standalone Surface Studio display. Yep. You know, second generation Surface Hub. And then, of course, Windows on ARM. You know, what will Surface do around Windows on ARM, and when will they do it? You know, I don't have any information. I have some information about some of this stuff. I have some information, and the Andromeda stuff, of course. I don't have any information about anything that's coming in the next 12 months, like nothing.
Wow, really?
And so, nothing. Like, I have some information for stuff past that, but that's a long time.
Now, wait, what about the new Surface Book next year? No,
I have nothing about that. That's what I'm saying. Like, that's what makes me think it's not happening now.
Yeah.
I don't. You know. In other words, we're not going to see one in October. That's my guess based on the fact that I have literally nothing.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to see one in October. I think the original intent or idea was we would see one this fall. At one point, we were all hearing that rumor, but we've all stopped hearing that rumor now, right? So.
Yeah, and I wonder if the success of Surface Laptop is causing a problem for that, because Surface Book is well regarded, but it doesn't sell well because it's very expensive. Mm-hmm. Surface Laptop is also very well regarded, but it's not exactly inexpensive. But compared to Surface Book, it's certainly more affordable. I think that product becomes their volume Surface device at some point. I mean, I think
that
that's
what
everybody wants. Yeah. So although, I mean, I wonder if that doesn't squeeze out Surface Book a little bit.
We don't have any data so far on how Surface Laptops are selling, do we?
No.
So yeah, I would be interested in hearing that. I don't know if we will or when we will.
The other thing I sort of have a guess on is just when you think about Windows 10 on ARM, I can't remember if this just came up today. I think it did, but I think a lot of people misunderstand the point of the product. The idea is that Windows 10 on ARM is just Windows 10. So Windows 10 Home, Windows 10 S, Windows 10 Pro, Windows 10 Enterprise. It's not special version of Windows 10 for ARM, right?
Right.
The goal is if this thing works properly, you'd never even care to look to see what it was. It just works. You don't really think about it. I think they're going to take that same approach with devices. I wouldn't be surprised to see them take Surface Pro and or Surface Laptop and just make an ARM version of each, you know, actually use the same hardware. Again, this is not based on any information. This is just me speculating, but it seems like that would be the way to go.
Let me
ask you a question. If Surface Laptop had been released first, do you think we would still have Surface Pro and Surface Book?
Well,
I do.
You do? So you think there's enough of a differentiation?
I think so, because I feel like Surface Book is aimed at like the people who are doing high-end creative tasks like architecture, right? Like, you're not going to use a Surface Laptop for that. Surface Laptop is more for your general use case. And as we've heard, it also is a design that dates back a couple of years that Microsoft finally produced. So I think there is a market for the Surface Book.
But do you think that the Surface Book would have had a detachable screen if Surface Laptop had appeared first and gone gangbusters? I think the answer to that is no. It'd probably be like a workstation class laptop.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. They seem to love the idea of 2-in-1 devices. And, you know, the market numbers show that that's a smart bet right now, that a lot of people like that. I don't particularly like it, but I'm not the usual user. So I think they probably would have still had the detachable screen. I think they consider that like a differentiator from their OEMs and a selling point.
Yeah, you got these two opposing forces here, though, right? Because there's nothing innovative about a laptop, right? And which explains why they had to do Alcantara, just try to make it look kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. It, you know, Microsoft in 2017 finally shipped its first laptop. It's kind of ludicrous when you think about it.
Yeah.
But one of the things they started pushing with the release of Windows 8 was this notion of 2-in-1s. So we're going to take the iPad form factor and bring it to the PC. And it's been popular to a point. I mean, the one thing that's really interesting about Surface Pro is that it's been, ever since Surface Pro 3, every PC maker on earth has copied this thing. Like, there are dozens of Surface Pro clones out in the market. That's very interesting.
Some of which are very, very good.
Yeah.
I have to wonder, because again, like you said, we don't know what the sales are, but I really do think Surface Laptop is going to take off in a major way for Microsoft. And there's got to be a little bit of a comeuppance to that, because they probably, this thing, like you said, had been sitting there for years. This design dates back a long time. And they didn't want to release it because, you know, it's just a laptop, right? So I think that they basically were kind of forced to release it because they needed to get the reliability stuff under control. This is before Consumer Reports, by the way. This is the reliability problems they had experienced with Pro 4 and Surface Book. And I think maybe they're not surprised, but I think they're going to discover, like, oh, look, we do a traditional form factor and it does really well. Like, there's a market for some kind of an Apple quality Windows 10 PC, you know, and I think it's going to impact what they do going forward.
Interesting part of the story is the two products in the Surface lineup that I think have garnered the most buzz have been the Studio and the laptop. And those were the two designs that they basically pulled specs out from a closet 3 years old, 4 years old, and just threw it in the market. It's
what's weird about those two things, too. You're right. The Surface Laptop is right now basically the most affordable Surface. It's not affordable, but within the confines of the Surface lineup, it is. Surface Studios, aside from Surface Hub, is the most ridiculously expensive Surface PC.
Okay. Now, Paul.
Yes.
If you had a Surface Laptop
Listen, she's gone. Let's talk about her.
Oh, yeah.
No, go ahead.
Okay, first of all, I don't think that she'll ever be able to play Cuphead, so it's going to be hilarious when
actually, it's incredibly difficult to play. I kind of downplayed that because I didn't want her to be freaked out. But
Yeah. It's one of those basically moving bullets, dodging mm-hmm. bullets where you have to contort your character.
You will get epilepsy just playing this game.
So often. It's amazing. Yep. So basically, what I see is Mary Jo Foley spending about an hour and a half on the first level without getting 50% of the way through, which is going to be
the notion
hilarious.
That Mary Jo would ever spend an hour and a half on any video game is too ludicrous to even contemplate.
Editor, we have to cut this part out of the episode.
Yeah, this never happened.
This never happened. Oh, but seriously, if they release a new Surface Studio and a new Surface laptop with up-to-date specs, with modern CPU, with enough memory that it actually helps creatives, they become best sellers, don't they? I mean, that was the one thing about the Surface Studio. It got so much attention. But people were lamenting the fact that the specs just weren't there.
It was laptop parts, like quad-core laptop parts. And it's loud, and this is the problem. It's got the fan comes on instantaneously. It's, it's like this beautiful screen let down by the body, So, which is the problem with me. It's a beautiful brain and body by Chardonnay over here. So, I don't know. So I can't even get past that. That was the dumbest thing I've ever said. So I think there's a generational thing that has to happen with Surface where they move past this old fashioned Surface Connect USB 3 expansion base that they have. And they move to something modern that's based on the basically limitless potential of Thunderbolt 3 and USB-C. I was very curious. They didn't do it with Surface Studio last year. And then they released two major new releases this year and still haven't done it. And so I think what we're seeing is this dividing line between the old and the new, and that this move to ARM maybe is part of what triggers the move to this new generation platform for Surface. That maybe the reason Surface Book isn't happening right now is they're like, you know what? Let's get past this generation of stuff, and we'll start releasing things in 2018, or maybe they could announce in WinHack at the end of December at the end of the year that this is what we're doing. We'll see. I this is just guesswork on my part, but mm-hmm. when I look forward to future Surface devices on the desktop or portable devices, they have to move to this architecture. They just have to.
Yeah.
The whole industry has already done this.
So sorry, I had to jump off. I was getting a package that I've been waiting and waiting for. I was like, oh my God, finally. Okay. Taro Alhonen, who's listening, says, what about the Cannon Lake delay to Q4 2018? Could that be affecting Surface Book 2? Good question.
No, I don't think Cannon Lake has anything to do with Surface Book
2. You don't?
Two.
Though, right? Do we have any information on that? What processor
we don't know anything about Surface Book 2. But remember, they just can't. Here's what would be ideal for Surface Book 2 right now. The processors they just announced, quad-core versions of supposedly, what is it, eighth generation with the quotes around it. That's the Surface Book underpinnings, right? You go quad-core and Surface Book. That's all they need.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I think what they did was, I can only get, right? So we're guessing here. I just want to be really clear about this. There's no inside information. But thinking about it logically, the choice before Microsoft is we can release this thing this year on that chipset we just described. I can't forget the name of it. The new one is.
Not KB Lake,
Cannon Lake.
Just came out this summer?
Oh, KB Lake?
No, was a while back. What was the last Cannon Lake?
What is it?
It is, right?
A chat room. Which one? Coffee Lake? No, that's not it.
It's supposed to. Coffee Lake's the next one, right?
Eighth generation Intel Core processors are now quad core, right?
That
perfect
thing.
For Surface Book. But like I said, we're still facing this generational jump that has to happen at some point.
Yeah.
So do you wait until next year? And maybe we do a bunch of these things over at one time. I think this new USB-C based power and expansion with Thunderbolt 3 makes tons of sense for an ARM-based device too.
Yeah.
And so maybe this is how this transition happens. It has to happen at some point. And so if they put Surface Book out now, 2 years after the original one, and then next year go to a new architecture, they're kind of stranding this product in a way. Because it creates a shorter life cycle for it. It almost kind of makes sense just to wait. Because there's a couple of little things they can do. They can always upgrade the GPU in the performance-based version. That's easy. They can always go to a different processor that's kind of in the basic same generation of Intel stuff. That's easy. But maybe we're at the point now, and again, I think Surface Laptop informs this. If Surface Laptop had kind of fallen flat a little bit, maybe they would have thought differently. But I have a feeling that thing's going well enough that they're thinking, we don't have to worry about this.
Another interesting point is, so we were talking about there that you saw somewhere today, Paul, that the Surface Pro LTE information had leaked. Here's where it is. Winfuture.de. They've got Surface Pro LTE will have eSIM support, 128, 256 gigabyte i5 only, launching US December 1. So that's pretty specific.
That's very specific. That's different. The thing I saw was just a UK retailer.
Okay. So this, if this is right, that makes a lot of sense all the way across, right?
Yep.
So that could be what the big Surface announcement is this year.
So you go to London to announce this.
Right. You don't do it in the US where you have like multiple TV appearances and tons of media here in the US that you want picking up all the stories.
It's inconvenient for me because getting to New York is easy, but I sort of understand Microsoft's desire to do the, especially smaller events, to do them internationally because Surface is no longer launching in the US and Canada only when they first launched. They're launching internationally. So UK being part of Europe, it's important for them that this thing do well there, and it's probably going to be available day one there. That's fine. It's not a big thing. If this was like the next generation of Surface Book and Laptop and Pro all together or some kind of thing like that, that would be super inconvenient. But I would expect that to actually happen in New York still.
Yeah.
All right, let's go ahead and talk a little bit about some mixed reality, because that arguably is one of the most exciting products that I saw at the last GDC here in San Francisco. There's going to be another event here in San Francisco on October 3rd, which is invitation only, and I really wanted to go, except now I'm going to be sitting in a courtroom for jury duty.
I know, right?
Uh-oh. So I'll be close to it. I'll actually be a couple of streets away from it, but I'll be in a courtroom.
Yeah.
What are we expecting?
Just this one's more, I don't want to use the words rehash, but rehash. Yeah.
What's the rationale, right? In other words, it's right before the holidays. I think what they want to do is get this stuff in front of people who, are either super friendly to Microsoft, which there are some, but also to get in front of people who maybe aren't familiar with this technology, wouldn't necessarily know anything about it, and try to get them excited about it so that they can write about it and drum up a little excitement for this stuff.
And hopefully to clarify it a little, because like when you, like you keep seeing things when people are writing about Microsoft and mixed reality, they're like, it's just virtual reality. They're calling it mixed reality, but it's really just VR. And I feel like Microsoft's trying to make the case that HoloLens and these mixed reality headsets could actually at some point work together in tandem, and that their vision is bigger than just trying to slap a new name on something that everybody else has been calling virtual reality.
Well, fortunately, Mary Jo, it is virtual reality.
I know.
But I mean, I think what they've done, because they're Microsoft, right? They're a platform maker. Yeah. And so they've created a single platform where developers can create solutions that run on both, and if you have true holographic capabilities, you can do more or whatever. But this is basically a way to formalize, they're calling it mixed reality. I hate that, but a virtual reality platform, for Windows. I don't know.
There's also a Google event the day before or after, like in San Francisco. So they're thinking, we've got all these press people coming to San Francisco for the Google event. So why not, that's capitalize on that?
That's for the Pixel. Yeah. And then in September on the 26th in Mountain View, there are a series of events that Microsoft is hosting, which will be covering everything from enterprise analytics to mixed reality to AR. And they're supposedly doing some sort of hands-on demo. So they're really pushing this platform at the end of the year. That's a little surprising.
Apple just came out with iOS 11, and all of a sudden we're starting to see these kind of AR experiences occurring on the phone. And I was playing around with a couple of them today in anticipation of some article I'll write about augmented reality in iOS. And it has sort of confirmed my worst fears, which is that tethering a headset to a PC, and then, of course, it requires fairly big specs to do you know, decent quality graphics and so forth, or decent frame rates at least, is not the same as just the thing you walk around with. And so this morning on my iPad, I was reading the newspaper and I saw something about, I think it was about augmented reality. It made me think, oh, I should go look in the store in the iPad now because it's iOS 11 and see what they have, and downloaded a couple of things. And I, you might have seen the picture I put on Twitter of my cat walking through the game I was playing on the floor. And, you know, unfortunately for Microsoft, you know, when they don't have this mobile play, this is how this kind of stuff gets popularized. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sure that Windows Mixed Reality is more capable than what I was doing on my goofy iPad this morning with the cat. But, yeah, it's just no idea. It was kind of a nice, it was kind of just a great timing because I literally had wanted to take a screenshot to save for later, and the cat started walking through there. So it was kind of perfect. Mm. But
that's actually a market. AR for pets. That could be hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah, they could combine like a laser pointer thing on the back of the iPad or your phone. And yeah.
Yep. You can just put animals in certain spots and the pets will just go after them. Microsoft, we're thinking that this is the next billion-dollar idea, Microsoft. Jump on it.
The other thing is, you know, I've often complained about like the HoloLens field of view thing, and I haven't seen a mixed reality headset yet, or I haven't put one on, so I'm not really sure how that works there. I would imagine it's not anything like that. But, you know, it is – I think the fundamental disappointment to HoloLens is that kind of field of view, because you're immersing your head in this thing, and you've got this, you know – panoramic normal view of the room or whatever, but you can only see the holograms here. Whereas, you know, when you're looking at the world through your phone, which we're used to by taking photographs, you know, this is a very common thing to do, to view the scene around you through this thing, which is by definition a narrow field of view. It's a little more natural, right? Mm. And I think it's just because we're just used to doing it, you know, whereas your expectation when you put on this thing over your head is that you're going to, now I'm going to be immersed in these things, and you're not. It's kind of just in front of you.
Well, there's also, it really shows you how much we depend on peripheral vision. That was the thing about trying on HoloLens. It was the fact that, it was beautiful as long as I was looking straight forward. But I'm used to getting information around the edges. And if I don't have that, my brain freaks out.
Yeah, and there are interesting examples of that, like just a simple thing where you have a holographic ball that bounces on the table in front of you. And it's very realistic because it does a great job of sensing the surface, but then it bounces outside of your field of view. And so, of course, what they do, and you can almost sense how things were created with HoloLens, because in that case, they use the positional sound that exists. It kind of creates a 360 scape of sound around you. You can hear the ball bouncing on the floor to your right. And so you kind of know to look that way for it. It kind of it aids you a little bit, but it's not the kind of normal, we don't think of it this way, but immersive experience that you have just, you know, by being out in the world like a real person, whatever.
Mm-hmm. All right, I do want to move on a little bit to the new
preview.
How dare
you?
Now, I actually turned off previews on most of my workstations because the updates were killing some of my applications. And a lot of my hardware, but I still have it enabled on one. What can I expect out of 16.291, Paul?
There is a feature. There's actually a new feature in this build, which is kind of interesting. So there's a feature coming in the Fall Creators Update, which is called Continue on PC. It requires you to install a mobile app on your phone, your Android phone, or your iPhone. And the idea is that you are doing some, you know, browsing around the web or whatever it might be, and you want to continue on your PC. And so you basically do it through the share interface on either one of those platforms. You'll see a continue on PC. You click on it. If you have multiple PCs, you get to choose which PC you get to do, if you want to do it right now or do it sometime in the future. And so that's already, it's kind of up and running. It works. It's a little ponderous, but it's kind of an interesting way to interact between your mobile device and your PC. So the feature they've added to Windows 10 in this new build is a way to operate that stuff using Cortana. And so now the continue on your PC stuff will be available through Cortana, meaning you can control it with your voice as well. So in other words, you could sit down at your PC, you could go up to the Action Center. I don't know, I'm doing it here so you can see it, so it'll be easier for everybody. And that stuff should be in there as notifications. And you could say, you know, continue where, you know, pick up where you left off or whatever, however it's worded. Now you can just sit down at your computer and tell, say, hey, Cortana, I'd like to, whatever it was. I don't want to give everyone's Cortana a command, but You should be able to pick up where you left off. Typically, you're browsing the web, let's say, and you want to now open that thing in your web browser, and it will just do it with your voice.
That's actually a feature that I would install that preview build for, because I find myself doing that all the time. I'm always switching between devices, and right now my MO has been I use Chrome on everything, so just save it as a bookmark.
Because it syncs. That's right.
It comes over. But if I could sit down and say, hey, pick up where I left off, that's cool.
It's funny because this is not to get off on a sidetrack too much here, but that is an interesting thing because we have moved past the point where we have to manually recreate things everywhere. Like we used to always connect our phones to our computers to download photos and do stuff like that. Mm-hmm. If I'm doing something like even, you know, I take a couple of product shots of something and I'm going to write about it here on my computer, I don't ever connect the phone to the computer. I download the photos from Google Photos because they're backed up the second I take them. You know, those connections aren't really as necessary. And like you said, I do the thing that you just described all the time. All the tabs that I have open on this computer, if were open earlier, it doesn't have to be right now. If I go in the other room and I'm on an iPhone or an Android device or whatever, I can bring up Chrome and go find those things and, you know, take off right where I was. It's that kind of thing is super useful. Super useful.
So this is part of pick up where you left off, yes?
Well.
Or no?
So pick up where you left off is in the same family of things, right? So in other words, you were doing some stuff, maybe your computer rebooted, maybe you log into a different computer, and now you want to pick up where you left off. And it will say, hey, you were running Edge, you were running Word, do you want this stuff again? Yeah. This is more of like a cross-device kind of thing. I actually said pick up where you left off. I don't believe that's the language they use, but it's the same type of thing, except in this case, you're explicitly saying from your mobile device, I want this on my PC.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And you can do it right now, but maybe you're out at night or something and you're on the phone and you're like, tomorrow, I want to remember this. And so you say, put it on my PC. You choose the PC if you have multiple PCs. You know, through your Microsoft account. Mm-hmm. And then it can say, put it there now or do it on a timer. Mm-hmm. So, and you can say, remind me in 6 hours. And so if you sit down in front of your computer the next morning, what you should see is a notification and it will be up in Action Center where it will actually load. It will load an Edge because, you know, unfortunately, that's how this feature works. But it will load the thing you were looking in the browser.
Okay. So this is like part of what they talked about coming at Build, but not all of it. Right.
That's right.
It's like a step along the way, right?
There's all this other stuff. I'm so hard with names, but it's not Time Machine, right? That's an Apple
timeline.
Timeline's not going to be there right in this release, but that's a cool idea, and I think that relies on buy-in from app makers. So, in other words, Timeline doesn't help that much if there are no apps that support it, right? So, the idea is that you want to scroll back through time and say, you know, yesterday afternoon I was working in Adobe Photoshop, I had some images, I was working in Microsoft Word, I had some text, I was doing whatever I was doing. I want to get those things back, and I want to get them back to the way they were then, you know, not the way they are now, that kind of thing. It's a good idea, but it requires the apps to support it.
Right. So a lot of what is enabling this pick up where you left off stuff is the Microsoft Graph, right? It was that Windows was going to now start being one of the endpoints for the Microsoft Graph. So that's interesting. It means they're starting to get that to work, and there'll be more probably in 18.03, the next Windows 10 release.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Yeah. So it's, you know, for a little while there, it seemed like they weren't going to get any of this in the fall Creators update. Right. And actually there's some stuff, you know, it is interesting. There aren't hard stops and when they can put this stuff in, because Cortana, the way that works, they could actually add stuff to Cortana over time. So it could even get better between now and then in some ways, right? There are some things that could happen, but I think the stuff they shut off last year at Build, you know, I don't want to, Microsoft, I don't want to promise anything, but I mean, it seems like that stuff should be possible by the next release right after the Fall Creators update.
Yep.
All right, let's go ahead and talk a little bit about, I don't know, the fact that there are so many people using Edge that Microsoft should be proud. They have publicly stated that there are over 330 million people using Edge right now. And then there are some journalists who are maybe perhaps doubting those numbers.
Well, I mean, I didn't mean this to turn into a controversy, but I just would like to point out that it is impossible that there were 330 million people actively using Microsoft. It's not possible.
Well, it depends. How do you define actively using? Because I actively use it to install Chrome.
Right. So I and others have pointed out things like that. But I think without being like cynical about it, I guess what I would say is we know there are supposedly still 500 million. There are more than 500 million, but 500 million Windows 10 users. The notion that 2/3 or more of them are using Edge is inconceivable. But whatever. I'm not trying to get preconceived notions in the way of facts. I mean, we have data from any, you can look up anyone you care to you care to believe, but StatCounter, net market share, whoever, people look at usage share on the web. They call it market share, but it's usage share. We can have some understanding of how many people are using the internet from desktop computers, meaning PCs and Macs, not mobile devices, PCs and Macs. And we can look at what the usage share is for Microsoft Edge on these, according to these services. And the usage share is anywhere from 2 to 5% at most. Well, if there are 1 billion people browsing the web on desktop computers or 1.5 billion, whatever number you choose to believe, you can do some simple math and say, well, how many of them are using Microsoft Edge? And it is never anywhere near 330 million. It is 1/5 of that number or less. So the question now is, why on earth would Microsoft have said there's 330 million active, I think they actually said active Edge devices or whatever, but okay, we'll call them users. It's basically the same thing. Microsoft has really good telemetry data, right? I mean, I don't mean to suggest that they're lying, but I guess what I am saying is if those people are using Microsoft Edge, they're not using it to browse the web. And that makes me wonder. It's still kind of a big leap, but Microsoft Edge is the default PDF viewer in Windows 10.
And it actually does it quite well.
Yeah, it works fine. And honestly, I think for most people, I'll throw them this bone. I think most people confronted by Edge as a PDF viewer would say, yeah, this is fine. I don't have to do stuff with it. And by the way, Edge has advanced PDF features. You can fill in forms. You can annotate PDFs. You can draw on it if you have a pen. It does do all this stuff. I'm not trying to suggest it's not capable. But, okay, I mean, I guess if half of all people who use Windows 10 you did this, that's 250 million right there. I mean, maybe, but I think the issue I have with that is that this figure was presented at a virtual conference aimed at web developers, right? And it's a little disingenuous to suggest to that audience that number because it, again, suggests usage on the web. That this is, in other words, the idea is you guys need to make sure you're supporting Microsoft Edge because look, we have 330 million users. If the majority of them are reading PDFs and not browsing the web with this product, that's unfair to say something like that. So I've heard privately from Microsoft that they're not very happy with me right now. So I guess what I would say is...
It would be nice to know what they're measuring, right? Like how did you guys get that number?
We're not going to ever hear that. I don't think we're ever going to hear that. So I think the closest we're... Well, I don't expect them to make a public statement about it. I asked for one, by the way. But all I'm saying is the data is out there. And so you can believe there are 1.5 billion people browsing. I did the math. You can read it in my article. But 1.5 billion people browsing the web on a PC or Mac. Mm-hmm. You can look at the usage share of Microsoft Edge in single digits. Give them 5%. Say it's 10%, 10% of 1.5 billion is whatever number. It's not 330 million. And so the discrepancy is what? I mean, I think the discrepancy is PDF, I guess. I don't think it's ebook readers, although you can do that in Microsoft Edge as well. I think it's probably PDF. So yeah. I don't know.
I could absolutely see it being PDF because everyone's going to be clicking on a PDF at some point and it's going to pop up Edge. They might not even know it's Edge. All they know is,
works. I'd like to think that an active user machine, whatever you want to say, is not, doing what you're saying, which is what I've also said, launching it so you can install Chrome. Mm-hmm. You could make Chrome your default browser and Edge will still launch in some cases. I have to think that they're at least intellectually honest enough not to take misclicks as usage. I mean, I believe that to be the case. I don't think of Microsoft as a dishonest company. But yeah, that's a curious number. It's a curious number.
And I do have to say that there's nothing wrong with Edge. It's definitely not IE. Edge is actually, it's a decent experience. It does many things better than Chrome. many, many things better than Firefox. It is the smoothest browsing experience. When I use it with Google Docs, I can actually scroll my screen rather than chunking through it, which is strange because that's a Google product as well. But for me, what does it, there's two things. One, extensions. I use extensions. And two, it has to be everywhere. I've got Chrome on my PC, on my Mac, on my iOS, and on my Android device.
So I have that. Both those problems, I have a few more other problems with it. I actually use the web app feature in Chrome extensively and love it, and that's a problem. But I will say this, and I mentioned this very briefly on Twitter yesterday, I think, but I've been updating my Windows 10 book for the Fall Creators Update, and I took a way longer than expected amount of time to convert the Edge chapter over to write about all the new functionality that's coming in this release.
Right.
There's a lot of stuff. It's very interesting to me that this chapter, which clocked in at roughly 50,000 words, 10,000 words, about 50 pages, lots of illustrations, could be a small book in its own right, right? I don't cover basic web browsing functionality. I assume everyone knows how to browse the web. They know about bookmarks or favorites. They know how tabs work. Only talking about the stuff that is unique to Edge. There is a lot to write about with that product. It's kind of amazing to me. And yet I still can't use it, right? And it kind of shows you what a big problem this thing is for Microsoft, because they have made something that has a ton of unique functionality, a ton of unique features. And yet there's like the little picky things. There's always something, you know, and that it's hard to overcome that last mile, I think, for a lot of people.
Yeah. Mary Jo, I did want to bring one thing up from the Microsoft blog on the Creators Update. And Alex, if you go to my screen, this is the bit of data that, if true, if measured accurately, is actually kind of astounding. They're showing that as the base of Windows 10 users has increased, the customer support contacts have actually decreased. Now, that's what you want to see. It means that the operating system is becoming more mature. There are fewer issues. They're actually addressing issues that customers have had. Have you seen this? Have you seen this trend?
Hold on a second. Paul. No, by the way, this data is... I'm sorry. Think about it. What's happening over the course of this time is that people are upgrading from Windows 10 to Windows 10. So they're already used to the operating system. That orange line at the bottom is not a percentage. It's the number of actual calls.
Right.
So what's the percentage? I mean, what's the percentage against new users? Is it of course it's going to go down. Everyone's used to Windows 10. Is it really because Windows 10 has gotten better?
Well,
or is it because?
Let's step back.
I have
from
a problem. I got to stop looking at math. I am broken.
By the way, Paul, if Microsoft was upset with you for the Edge thing,
I know. I gotta just stop. You know what? Windows 10 is super reliable. That graph is awesome. I love it. That's good. It's all good.
No, wait. So today, the timing of this is also very interesting, right? Today, Microsoft put out a blog post that said Windows 10 Creators Update is the best version of Windows 10 ever. Okay, they say this about every version of Windows.
That's awesome.
Every time a new version comes out, but what's interesting in this blog post to me, not so much the customer support contact data, because I would say what's making this better is that they've been staging the releases, right? So when they first started releasing Windows 10, it was like, blah, here's Windows 10, everybody go get it. And there was a ton of incompatible drivers and people were having all kinds of problems. Then they started staging it where they would say to you, okay, now we think you're ready, go get it. And some people still went out and got it proactively, but more people waited, like I waited till I got that message. But the part to me that's more interesting in this blog post is some of the fundamental stuff that they're emphasizing that's better in the Fall Creators Update. So these are not brand new features that they're talking about in this. This is, I almost feel like this is a blog post for business users who are like, why should I install something called upgraded. Fall Creators Update, where like the key features are things like Story Remix, right? Like, why do I care about that? I don't. So the things that they're emphasizing here is, okay, we made some significant improvements to battery life. If you are using Edge, if you're one of those people who is, we have brought you a 17% improvement of battery life if you use Edge as your browser. They talk about how they've made a 40% power efficiency improvement in the Mail app that's bundled with Windows 10 in the Fall Creators Update. Booting up your device, now 13% faster. And logging in after boot up 18% faster. Windows Hello facial recognition up 30%. That one I really do believe, because when I tried the Surface laptop, it was so, like, that wasn't even running Fall Creators Update, and that was already so much faster than the last time I tried Windows Hello. So this whole post is about, you know what, if you don't care about any of the glitzy creator things, we actually did do a lot of under the cover stuff that you're going to like.
Well, which, by the way, is one of the things I've been asking them for, like, just work on the fundamentals, you know? So I think what they're trying to make the case for is that that's been happening under the covers. What I'm trying to figure out is, I'm looking at this chart that you showed earlier, and I'm trying to figure out if I was being overly harsh or whether this in fact does demonstrate improved quality.
And I think we, tell you, I don't know. This is just purely anecdotal, but I've gotten a lot fewer complaints about Windows 10 Spring Creators Update compared to previous versions of Windows 10 and people having complete meltdowns when they install it. So
I will say that the complaints from the Creators Update were dramatically fewer than those from the previous update, the anniversary update. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So your cat gets in your lap. My cat refuses to get on my lap, but I don't know if you could hear her, but she's walking around meowing because she can't stand that I'm doing something that is not petting her.
I'm the only one here without a cat.
You need one for the opposite.
You need something that's going to smother you when you're sleeping. It's important that we all have such an animal in our lives. Keep us on our toes.
Now, Paul, I will say that, of course, familiarity is going to decrease the number of service calls. That's a natural thing.
Yeah, right.
I'm trying to figure out if this is meaningful. I think that's maybe I jumped the gun there. I don't usually do that. I need to think this one over.
If you go back to that graph, where I do find the statistic meaningful is this little bump. So they have this bump around March of 2017, where you actually increase the customer support volume. That's kind of natural. You're talking about roughly half a year after the anniversary update. That's when people actually start poking around under the hood to see, oh, wow, this is new. Oh, I heard about this.
That's also when the Creators Update actually was released at first. Although, you know, it's kind of hard to say.
April is when they started rolling out the Creators Update, the spring one.
Yeah.
March, it was called March, right? But then it didn't start
But it was
rolling.
Available then. Like, so it makes sense that the very first, you could get it if you wanted it. I mean, but the part they're not showing you is the, go back to the graph again one more time. I'm sorry. Okay. So the anniversary update, what did it look like before then? Was it below where it is right there? Because it might have been, like, if you go to the very left, like, what if the left, if you kept going left from this chart, would it go down again? I bet it might. In other words, what they're really saying is, in mid 2016, we released the buggiest Windows 10 update we've ever made. And it's been better ever since. To which I'd say, yeah, it should be. Like, what's the data before that? I bet it goes up. I bet it goes down as you move left, I mean.
That actually, yes. That's.
I bet that was the apex of their problems.
The takeaway, getting rid of all the fuzzy math, the takeaway can be that there are more people using Windows 10 and there are more people comfortable with Windows 10.
Yes.
You can say that, right? I mean, that's not fuzzy. Yep. That's.
No. That makes sense. That's totally good. Makes sense. Yep.
Okay. So Windows.
And I think OEMs are getting more on board with getting drivers out, you know, updates to drivers more quickly, probably fewer problems with apps now. Like, so there are a lot of things contributing to this number improving.
2016 was kind of tough if you think about it. They had all that Surface reliability stuff in the first half of the year. Then the anniversary update hit and ruined it for everybody. It's no wonder they're really sensitive about reliability right now, right? And the Consumer Reports thing must have been like getting kicked between the legs. Like, they're literally trying to get ahead of this stuff, and then that happened. You know, that must have been just horrible timing for them.
Yeah.
My production machine actually got caught with that last big update that was destroying the timing on my devices, specifically me on my audio and my video devices. And so I would always be losing sync when I was importing. And that's one of those things where it's like, you can't do that. You're mucking with my livelihood now. You can't do that. That's not a little bug that you fix in a patch in a month. I have to roll back the operating system. So, I'm definitely not one of these people who thinks we're on a downward trend. And at some point, according to this graph, in I'd say January of 2018, right around here, that there will no longer be any need for a support desk if you're using
Windows 10. Yes, exactly. We're going to do support fully through the feedback hub.
All right, let's jump into mobile because we are coming close to the end of the show here. We do need to touch some of the interesting bits of news from around the Silicon Valley, not just Microsoft. We know that Google's next Pixel handset has been leaked. We know that one of them is a little blue Pixel, and people are excited. We've covered this pretty extensively on a couple of our shows, including All About Android. And I think what we've said about it is, look, the Pixel is it's Google's version of the Surface. It's a little exciting, a little boring, but it's very dependable and it's very consistent. What about the Google Pixel excites you, Paul?
Yeah, but this is a big difference. Nothing. So that's the problem. the problem is Google exists in a market in which there are Samsungs and there are Apples, and those devices sell for a lot of money, and they don't do anything to justify that price. And I kind of wrote a little open letter to them saying, look, Microsoft went through this before. You need to buy market share. You can't just show up with a stripped down phone and say, yeah, we're going to sell. These guys are selling phones for $950. Why can't we? Because you're Google and nobody cares about you. So you need to, they're pricing it wrong. That's my fundamental issue here. I am very interested in the new Pixels personally because I want to stay on Project Fi, which I love. But I need a better phone than what I have now. And it's $950, like seriously? It makes no sense. Now, I don't have it in the notes, but by the way, Google also announced today that the first Android One phone will be available in the United States from Motorola, the Moto X4. It will also be available in Project Fi and will be the first of a bunch of third-party and lower-priced phones that will be made available through the service. So actually, maybe things will improve soon. So we'll have to wait and see on that one.
Yeah. For me, I there are so many things I like about buying a pure phone, something like the Pixel. You get better updates.
Oh,
it's more stable. But I'm with you. The pricing just seems not right.
Two years ago, when they released the Nexus 6P and the Nexus 5X, those phones were about $200, if not more, less expensive than the flagships of the day.
Right.
That's the right price for a phone like that. It's the right price. Mm. That's the value. That's where you say, like, I'm getting a pure Google Android experience, and I'm paying less. Beautiful camera, you know, whatever it is. They just don't have the cachet to sell a phone like that. You can't just declare that you're a luxury brand. Like, it just doesn't work that way. They're going to fail. These are not going to do well.
This is the Microsoft Signature Series where you paid extra to have nothing installed on the machine. Did you take a look at the new Pixel Chromebook?
Yeah, that's the other thing. You know, I've always been intrigued by the Chromebook Pixels. Too expensive. And so I thought, well, you know, they took a year off. They'll come back maybe $700-$800. That makes tons of sense. Maybe I'll get one. And you could spend $2,000 on this thing. And I'm sorry.
It starts at $1,100.
Yeah, it's tough. That's Surface pricing. And so, you know, you're not making a good case for yourself at that price. Again, they're just pricing themselves out of the market, I think. My cat is freaking out. I don't know if you can hear it.
I've bought three Chromebooks. I have three Acer R13s. I gave one to my mother, one to my father, and I have one for myself. But they're $300 to $400 machines.
Yep. That's a nice computer.
Right.
Yeah.
Once I go up to $1,100, all the way up to $2,000, that's power user money. And I'm not going to be buying a Chromebook for power user money.
I don't have that money. I can't afford that. I mean, it's just not possible. So I'm kind of out of the running on all this stuff. It's just too much money.
Mary Jo, would you move to a Chromebook?
You know, I'm like the right candidate for a Chromebook because I am not a power user. I have very simple computing needs. And supposedly what on the Windows side would satisfy me would be Windows 10S, right? If I weren't a Chrome user, I guess I would be like, of course, I'm definitely like going to Windows 10S just because Windows is familiar to me. But I think I could live with the Chromebook. I don't have any must-have apps that are Windows only right now, except for, you know what, Notepad, but nothing else. And so I could be a Chromebook user. I just use Windows these days out of habit more than anything. And also
I think you would
because
be surprised
what I do.
By, how well Chromebook met your needs. I think it would be
totally fine.
An almost alarming incident, you know, where like, actually, yeah, this works fine, you know.
Well, that's why I got one of the first 10S laptops that came out for reviewers, because I had said to Microsoft, like, I think I could use a Chromebook. Like, I think, yeah, I'm the perfect use case for a Chromebook. And they're like, oh, wait, try this, you know.
Right.
So I think there are a lot of us who are these, quote, information workers who don't have power user needs, who could, yep, use a lot of different devices. We don't need a Surface Book. We don't even need a Surface laptop, right? I mean, right, more and more.
Yeah, you get one because you want one, you know, because you like the style, right, or whatever.
Exactly. Or you're comfortable with the operating system.
You've got too much money and you need some way to spend it, whatever the reason,
exactly,
might be.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you know, luxury item. So,
yeah,
I could use a Chromebook. I tried one when they first came out way back, yep, in the early days, and I hated it.
I still have the first one. You know, recently, Google sent me back then a Chromebook CR12, I think it was called.
Yeah. Yep. I'd had that too.
Kind of looked like the black MacBook of the day.
Yeah.
You know, back then it was terrible.
I know. And when we got it, you know, Wi-Fi has become a lot more ubiquitous now. And I remember just going around in New York and being like, how can I use this? Like, there's not Wi-Fi in most places. But now I feel like they're... Yeah. That's more prevalent.
Well,
and/or tether
actually,
your phone.
It works,
right,
better offline now as well.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly.
They're
right.
They're so much better than
offline.
The early versions. The early versions.
Oh, it was
were
so
useless.
Bad offline. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And
so,
actually, you know, these new Pixel devices are kind of interesting because they actually come with a bunch of storage, like the 128, yeah, 256, 512. And I think, yeah, a big part of that is with the move to Android app support. A, you'll have more apps on there, but B, mm-hmm, you'd be more likely to store content locally as well. You know, you, yeah, might. You can put documents and stuff on there now and not have to, mm-hmm, worry about, you know, always having it in the cloud.
Yeah.
That was a big surprise for me when I actually started diving into the R13. The fact that a lot of the things I expected to be able to still do on my Windows PC, I could now do, yeah, on my Chromebook, which I had, yeah, not been able to in the early versions. Also, the build, yeah, quality has vastly improved.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The early, yep, Chromebooks were these plastic fantastics with horrible keyboards, mouse pads, yep, trackpads that barely
always
worked.
11-inch screens, yeah, like terrible, yeah, devices.
But
it's,
but like,
really changed. And it also, you know, Mary Jo was talking about a typical information worker. I mean, think about like even like just a typical person. A lot of people, yeah, can get stuff done on a phone, you know. There might come a time where every once in a while you need to type out a letter or something and you maybe want to print or whatever. That's where a Chromebook comes in nicely because you can use it for those occasional instances where you need the biggest screen. I mean, you and I are writers. We want to sit down in front of the big screen and type on a real keyboard. Mm-hmm. That makes, yep, tons of sense. But for a lot of people, that's actually not a regular issue. And so a Chromebook kind of meets the needs of the occasional user as well, much better than a more complicated, you know, Windows laptop or a more expensive Macintosh.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's move away from Google because there's been some big moving and shaking in the iOS world. iOS, sure, 11 has dropped. Some people, like Steve Gibson, Twit's very own Steve Gibson, loves, mm-hmm, the way that it handles cookies. It's an incredibly, mm-hmm, intelligent way of dealing with third-party cookies that I think everyone is going to copy, everyone's going to adopt. Many people are saying, yep, iOS 11 is finally Apple coming into the enterprise, coming into its own. Paul Theriot has
amazing.
A slightly different idea, and that is iOS 11 is a hot mess.
Something weird has happened here. So just kind of bring this thing full circle. You know, Mary Jo was talking about Windows 10 S and how she could probably use that and how she probably could use a Chromebook. I did use Windows 10 S every day for 2 weeks while I was away over the summer. And I found it to be a very compromised experience. And so as a test, I went back and tried, well, maybe I could use a Chromebook. And I actually found that to be a far more natural experience. But the thing I was also doing on the side all summer long was trying out every single beta of iOS 11 on all my devices, including an iPad Pro with a keyboard, and trying to match what I need to do for work to that device. And actually, that one was far worse than any of the others. It's much harder to use as a productivity kind of, you know, device where you're typing a lot than is a Chromebook or Windows 10S PC. I've documented how unbelievably convoluted this is, but the couple of things I would just say here are that we've reached an interesting point with iOS because there is no such thing as just iOS. There's iOS on the iPhone, there's iOS on the iPhone 10, there's iOS on iPads, and then there's an iOS that's also on iPad Pros, and they all work a little differently in some circumstances. They even work differently depending on what kind of iPad Pro you have, you know, what you see in the split-screen view. There's a crazy two-handed multi-touch thing you can do where you hold something in space with one finger and then you navigate over here and then you drag the thing you're holding over here to the second thing. I mean, it's crazy. The system is crazy. And so I guess the thing I would just say to that is I have been talking for years about how Windows PCs are over here being very complicated. iOS devices are over here being very simple and they're moving toward each other. You know, Microsoft's trying to make Windows simpler, touch support and all that kind of stuff. Apple is maturing iOS to make it more productive and make it more capable and more something that people could use day to day for everything. I have always said that Apple's going to have an easier job of this than Microsoft. I got to say, after I'm seeing iOS 11, I'm not actually sure anymore. So I've followed Apple for a long time. I think they are going to get it right. I think based on history, it's going to be iOS 13 probably where it gets right. But productivity, multitasking on an iPad Pro with iOS 11 is insanity. And if Microsoft did this, Apple fans would never stop making fun of it. They would never stop making fun of it. It is
Microsoft
ridiculous.
Did do this. I mean, not like this. Right, of course, but a variation of this. The whole idea of Windows everywhere. It's the same Windows on your Surface RT as your desktop, as your notebook, and your mobile device.
That's complicated, and obviously there were some failures there. But I got to be honest, having one platform that works everywhere is probably not possible.
Right.
Microsoft has done a better job of it so far than Apple has. iOS is, I don't want to say ideal, but it works very well on mobile devices, on mobile form factors. It works a lot less well when you try to turn it into a Surface type device. What is my cat doing? My cat is in the trash barrel. Can you see it? She just came out of it.
Don't empty the trash.
You know what it is? Like people come to the home and they're doing work and it freaks out the cats. And so this is her trying to reassure herself that everything's okay. I got to pet her a lot, you know, whatever. Anyway, we're not here to talk about iOS, obviously, but if you were worried as a fan of Surface or as a fan of the PC that we're on the verge of this post-PC world that Steve Jobs had been talking about for a long time, you know what? You got a reprieve. You got a couple of years. You don't have to worry about it because this isn't going to do it. Chromebooks make way more sense than this thing. It's nuts. So I don't think we need to belabor the point, but it's like laughably stupid. Like it's crazy. I wrote a big article about it. You can step through it. You can see, I lay it out very clearly. I hope, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Over the summer, I was actually in Portland. I was helping one of my Jesuit brothers to buy a new device for him to take home to Zambia. And he actually almost bought into the Apple hype because the Windows Store and the Apple Store in downtown Portland are right next to each other. And he kept saying, I think I could do everything with an iPad Pro. And we went in there and I said, okay, well, here it is. I'm not going to say anything. Just try to do what you think you need to do. And it took him about 50 minutes of frustration for him to finally say, you know what? No, I'm not doing this. Let's go back over across the street to the Windows Store. I want to buy that HP 360.
Yeah.
I
do think they're going to get there. I want to be clear about that. There's some bits in there that do make sense. And there's some advancements in there that are viable. And it works with a keyboard. You can type and that's fine. But I think we all have it's not just that I'm not used to it. It's that it's not discoverable. It's not logical. It's not efficient. It just doesn't. It's not true to what this device is, you know? You're contorting it to do something that it wasn't meant to do. And it really shows through. Like it should be very clear to anybody.
I still really enjoy watching people at press events trying to type on one of those foldable keyboards on their lap as the tablet keeps trying to fall over.
Yep.
It's always entertaining. I've never done that, but so I know some people can.
The Apple keyboard cover is beautiful, assuming you like really small keyboards and only want one angle on the screen.
It's like a laptop, except it falls over and breaks easily.
Yep. Yeah. At least it's not expensive.
Right. Exactly. At least it doesn't cost as much as a laptop or more than a laptop.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
listener Q&A. This always has me interested because I don't know exactly how it works. We get to this every time.
Sure.
Is there actually any questions that we need to answer?
We've already answered all the questions. Okay. You know that.
That's what I thought. That's what I figured. So let's go ahead and jump into tips and picks. Paul, you are a man after my own heart. We've had a lot of questions about this recently, both on new screensavers and on know-how, about mesh wireless, whether or not that's going to solve all the problems that they have with dead spots, with connectivity in places that don't have wires. Is it ready? I mean, mesh wireless has worked really well in the enterprise for a very long time, for more than 20 years. But in a consumer space, it's always been difficult because it tends to be expensive and it tends to be spotty if it's not professionally installed.
No. No. Tell me about it. That's what's beautiful about it. So, look, to be clear, I've not tested a bunch of mesh networks side by side or anything like that, but I sort of evaluated what was going on earlier this summer, and I bought the Google Wi-Fi system. I got three access points. The house we were in before, because we moved this summer, was, you know, 1,600 square feet, kind of your basic colonial box, no big deal. But router at one side of the house, my wife's office on the second floor at the other side of the house, or my son's kind of the playroom in the cellar where he would have his Xbox on the other side of the house, the Wi-Fi was terrible. And so the way we solved that back in the day was poorly by slowly putting kind of wired networking through the house. We never did a full house upgrade. We just kind of did it piecemeal. It was really kind of lousy, but it did get that full speed connection through the house. And so it kind of solved the problem. There are other ways you can do this. Obviously, they have little network extenders, which I've always found to be kind of complex. I used some Apple stuff for a while for that. They have home line based networking extenders as well. There's all kinds of things you can do. But coming to this house, what I wanted was something that was simple, right? And something that actually worked. And I'm not super interested in high end features or the very best thing, or it doesn't have to be super expensive. I just wanted something that worked, you know. And this is a much bigger house than we used to have, and fully done over a cellar. So the cellar is like a living space as well. It's a big house that goes in every direction. I don't know how we're ever going to take care of this place. But anyway, I thought I'd get the 3-node Google Wi-Fi thing and see how it went. And if it didn't work out, I would do what I did before. I'd wire the house for Ethernet poorly. But I got to say, after having actually, we put it in 2 months ago, but we moved about a month ago. So I've been using it for a month straight. It's never, ever gone down. It's never had any problems. The throughput is astonishing. I test it from every room in the house, and it's very consistent. I didn't do a particularly sophisticated job of positioning these things, but I have one upstairs, I have one in the cellar, and I have the one that's in the room away from me. I have been doing everything that I do over wireless, and I never do that. My home computer hasn't been on Wi-Fi actually ever. I've always done wired internet at home on my own computer. So I've been purely wireless. This podcast is purely wireless. I mean, the throughput is astonishing. But the best part about it, really, aside from just the reliability of it, is how easy it is to set up. It's super simple. And it's not super expensive. I think you can get it right now for about $270 for the three parts. But I think my old house, I could have just used the one, but probably would have been about $120 or whatever. But it was sort of an experiment. And I have to be honest, I expected it to fail. I just thought, like, for my needs, I think of myself as kind of a power user. I'm going to need more than this. And honestly, it's fantastic. I video game over it, no problem. My son was downstairs on his computer, on his Xbox. I'm in here on an Xbox or my PC. I'm out in the living room with a 4K TV, streaming in 4K. And it works. It works fine. So there's going to be more 4K video happening soon here. We're going to get that Apple TV. And we're going to use 4K more than we do now. And we'll see. It's still possible. I might need a wire there. But I got to say, I can't recommend this highly enough. I mean, I cannot believe how well it works.
Right.
It's great.
And you know, the enabler is that this is not the same mesh that you heard of even five years ago. 5 years ago, it was basically a hodge together version of WDS. That you would install on an old router using OpenWRT or DDWRT. This is all controller-based. And when you have controller-based mesh, it works so much better. Actually, Alex, if you go back to my screen, one of the things that you get is you get, you know, yours, Paul, is very, very simple right now. But the management screen actually shows you what's being routed through where. And this is an amazing system once you get into a more complicated network, because you can see exactly what devices are hooked onto your network, where they're connecting to, where the mesh is running, and what kind of data
you can. You can see this. I just don't show it. It's just not in that screen. But you can go and look at that stuff. You can do things like, I want to connect this through this one all the time, or I want this one to have priority for this time, or whatever it is. You can do all that stuff. And it does this, you know, guest networks and you can sleep the network so your kids can't use it at night. You can do it. It has all that stuff. But it's just, you set it up and it works. I mean, we all work in an industry where nothing works ever, where every day there's some confusion about why was this thing. It happened when we logged on to Skype. Why is the sound not working? I have not made any configuration changes. That's how our whole industry works like that. Like, this is this beautiful island of tranquility in an area where nothing ever works. And yet there it is working. It's working now. It's working great.
I will really make like it. One techie note here, because there are some people out there who are looking at Ubiquiti or Unify solutions. And anytime you hear mesh paired with the word controllerless, that doesn't actually exist. It just means the controller is in the cloud. So the controller is someplace else. A lot of the systems that you buy for home use, like the one that Paul is using, they cost a tiny bit more, but the controller is local. The controller is typically in the first unit that connects to the network. That's the system that you're going to want, because unless you have a little bit of enterprise networking expertise, and you are absolutely confident that your connection to the internet is never going to go down, it's better to have the controller local than to have the controller remote, especially since some of those companies will eventually change their pricing features, and so suddenly you could have a mesh network that doesn't work because you didn't pay your monthly bill. That's not a great feature, honestly.
Sure.
But Paul, I'm with you. We've seen so many products come through this network that work, and it didn't used to be that way. Even three years ago, anytime we got a product that was a range extender or mesh, you just knew it was going to be a nightmare.
I've been doing wireless since I lived in Phoenix, and Wi-Fi wasn't even a thing. And so you got these proprietary wireless cards. You could put it in a PC MCIA slot in your laptop and had like an antenna on it, and you created your little goofy network and that stuff. Wireless has been unreliable from day one, you know, and you flash forward to today, and I cannot believe how well this thing's work. When I was in Barcelona over the summer, when I was still in Dedham and this thing was up and running, you could log in your mobile app and it would say Throt is online. Yes, that's so good. And, you know, and it would tell you how many devices were connected. It was always zero because nobody was here. And then, but I'd be in Barcelona. I'd be like, look, my network's still online. You know, my wife's like, stop looking at your phone. Let's go eat some paella or whatever. But I just love the whole, just the simplicity of it. It's just neat. I don't know. Sorry. I love something that works. I can't help it.
No, I'm the same way, because I used to love to build mesh networks with my old busted routers, but it's now to the point where the new products coming out work so well, it's not worth it to try to build your own.
I used to have switches everywhere too. I needed so many of them. I had so many things connected through. I can run everything. Everything runs over wireless. Like, it's fine.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's impressive.
All right, let's move to the app pick of the week. And I'm looking at the doc, and I realize this must be Mary Jo Foley's pick, because it's Forza Motorsports.
Yeah.
For Xbox and Windows 10.
I guess it was as of yesterday. You can download the demo for Forza Motorsport 7 on Xbox One and on Windows 10. And this is one of the games I tried on the Xbox One X last week at a showcase in New York. And it's amazing. I mean, Forza has always been like a showcase for Xbox, frankly, whatever version of Forza, whatever version of the Xbox. Right today, you'll need a PC to run it at 4K resolutions, obviously, but it is available. I think it's three or four tracks, and it's obviously a small subset of the whole game, but it's coming out beginning later this month. I think it ships broadly beginning of October, but you can try the demo today. We already mentioned this, but Better Together for Minecraft. I haven't seen it yet. They just announced this before the show. I looked to see, I don't see it yet, but it's coming out today. So if you're a Minecraft fan, be on the lookout for that. And the other thing I just wanted to point out was that Microsoft has a camera app for the iPhone called Microsoft Pix. It's only on iPhone. It's not on Android, but it's one of those kind of garagey type apps that uses AI to, you know, be a smarter camera and all that kind of stuff. And I've had bad luck on the iPhone 7 Plus with photography. It's the first iPhone I've had in a few versions where it wasn't as good as the previous version. So I actually did use this for a while. I didn't see huge advantages of using this over the built-in camera app. But what they have added to it is this capability that they already have in Microsoft Lens, and I think it's also, or sorry, in Office Lens, and I think it's also available in the OneDrive mobile app. But it's the ability to take pictures of documents, whiteboards, business cards, and things like that. And it will use AI to understand what that thing is and then correctly import that into your phone. And so one of the very neatest parts about it is if you take a picture of a document that will be at an angle because you're kind of looking down at it at 45 degrees, the picture you'll get will be straightened and chopped off correctly, which is amazing. And so they're kind of evolving this into an all-in-one camera solution on iPhone. So you should at least check it out. It's actually, it's very, very interesting. I mean, there's some crossover, like I said, with some other Microsoft apps, but if you're looking for one app that does it all from the camera perspective, this might be an interesting choice.
That's actually, it's a very slick implementation of AI and AI used right to fix the skew. I mean, wow. One other thing I do want to mention about Forza Motorsports, that it is the best demo if you ever want to do a multi-monitor setup, because it will actually, if you have a three monitor setup and you use the big curved monitors, it will, on the side monitors, it kind of stretches the perspective so that it looks like your peripheral vision.
The other thing you got to do is get Dolby Atmos sound going.
Oh, yes.
Because then you get like what is basically like a 360-degree sound field. I guess on the, I haven't tried this, but apparently on the Xbox One X, they're going to simulate Dolby Atmos over headphones. Oh. And supposedly it's excellent. And so if you can't afford those speakers, which I can't, you might in the future, if you get an Xbox One X, you might want to think about grabbing headphones just to try this. Because I heard it, like I did hear a surround sound effect where I was, but it's amazing. And I think that, you know, we talk about AR, VR, whatever, but that's what you're describing combined with that sound is that would be truly immersive.
Fantastic. All right, let's move to our enterprise pick of the week. Mary Jo, what is Redstone 4?
So Redstone 4 is the version of Windows 10 that's going to follow the Fall Creators Update. We sometimes call it 1803 because that's likely what it will be known among enterprise users. So far, we don't really know any of the new features that are coming to Redstone 4, even though there are some people in the skip ahead ring who are starting to test very early builds of it. But this week, we get a glimpse of one thing that is likely going to be in Redstone 4. So in June this year, Microsoft bought a company called Hexadite. Hexadite was founded in 2014 by some veterans of the Israeli Defense Force. They do a product called Automated Incident Response Solution, which allows users to investigate alerts and remediate threats without human intervention. So it uses some AI technology on the background. Well, it sounds like Microsoft has already integrated Hexadite's technology in with Windows Defender Advanced Threat Protection, which is their set of security solutions for Windows 10 enterprise users. And it seems like this will be one of the very first new features that will be available to testers of Redstone 4 on the enterprise side. So I'm betting pretty heavily that this technology will be part of Redstone 4 when it comes out next spring. So if you're somebody who is a Windows 10 enterprise user and you want to do end-to-end automated security protection, intervention, remediation, you will be very interested that this is going to be part of the product next year.
I saw a Hexadite demo.
Is that?
It must have been about a year ago. I can't remember what conference, but the feature that I hope makes it into the final release was the breach prevention. So it's this idea that if it sees a machine on a network that starts pushing out a lot of data to the internet when it doesn't normally do that, it flags it as suspicious. It stops it automatically and then flags or notifies an IT administrator to say, should this machine be doing this?
Yeah.
That, I mean, think about how many breaches would have been stopped if they had the system running at Sony or at Target or Home Depot or Equifax.
Yep.
That's very long overdue. That kind of AI can really, really make a dent in the exfiltration of data.
Definitely.
What about the codename pick of the week?
Yes, codename pick of the week is Honolulu. Honolulu is a graphical management solution for Windows Server, including the version of Windows Server that's coming out this fall, 1709. So in Microsoft's blog post where they talked about this recently, they said, we're readying a full technical preview to be available to anyone who wants to kick the tires of this at Ignite. So this is going to be out in technical preview form next week. So in the blog post, it was funny because they said, you know, we know there are people who grew up with graphical management systems like the Microsoft Management Console, and they really like the graphical tools for managing their enterprise servers and their networks. You know, we've got PowerShell out there, but some IT admins have told us that PowerShell is necessary but not sufficient, and they still want the GUI-based tools for managing their servers and networks. This is what Honolulu is going to be. It's going to be a web browser-based graphical management tool for servers. So we haven't seen this yet, but we should be seeing it next week and probably hearing about it next week at Ignite.
Nice. Okay, and now we need to move to my favorite part of the show, although it's my least understood because I don't actually drink alcohol, but the beer pick of the week.
Right. So I was thinking, you know, next week we're going to be in Orlando. People who are coming to Ignite should drink some nice Florida-based beer. And one of the best Florida-based craft breweries is called Cigar City. A beer of theirs that's very easy to find is called the Maduro Oatmeal Brown. So it's a brown ale, a little bit coffee-ish, a little bit chocolatey, really easy to drink. If you like brown ales, whether brown ales from Europe or US or whatever, I would say if you see this when you're in Florida, give it a try. Really, it's a really excellent version of the style of what a brown ale is. And it's from Cigar City, which is based in Tampa.
Not bad.
I should mention our meetup, too, since we're talking about beer.
Yeah, please.
Next week, Tuesday, the 26th, we're going to be doing a Windows Weekly meetup at World of Beer. And there are a lot of World of Beers in Orlando. So we're going to the one on Dr. Phillips Boulevard. So World of Beer, Dr. Phillips. Starts at 6 p.m. No RSVP needed. Just show up and come drink some beer with us.
Now, Mary Jo, there was a story involving a business that's about, half a block, two blocks down that way that deals with beer. And I think this is something that we need to do when you and Paul are next in studio. Alex, yes. Can you go to my screen? That's the fact that Lagunitas is now selling a cannabis-infused beer.
Good. Oh, man. Finally. Are they really?
But okay, here's the thing. It's not THC. So THC is the stuff in cannabis that gets you high. These are the terpenes, the little chemical aromatics. They give it the flavor and the taste.
You seem to know a little too much about this, if you don't mind me noticing.
He does.
Well, the infusion process is actually fascinating. It is a technological marvel. So, yeah, I'm guilty. I love learning about stuff like that. But when you do come, it could make for the most interesting Windows Weekly episode ever.
Yes.
It could.
and I have to say, I'm a little jealous that both of you are going to be at Ignite. I really wanted to make it out there this year. The schedule just never seems to work for me.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you've been, obviously there's another hurricane making its way through the Caribbean right now. And of course, what I'm thinking is this thing's going to hit Florida like the day I arrive or something, or the day we arrive. But actually, it looks like it's going to miss Florida. And because weather forecasts are never wrong, I'm not worried about it in the slightest. But that would be an amazing kind of post-apocalyptic nightmare if Microsoft had a tech conference right as a hurricane, hit that area. It would be just unbelievably bad.
It'd be like when we did, Tech Ed, when there were the fires in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be
PDC.
Yeah. PDC. Yep.
Well, I did Enterprise Connect in Orlando, Florida, and they had an outbreak of the measles. And so they had to inform all the conference attendees that they should get tested. So that was fun.
Well, I'm going to bring whatever this cold-like thing I have to Florida and infect everybody. So
get the mask.
Look forward to that.
Oh, actually, if you want, Paul, I will send you. I built a little something for Halloween. It's a mask. So it is a mask, but it looks like the mask from Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah, like the bad guy. The same actor, the guy from the Batman movie where he's got the thing on his face.
Right.
Or whatever.
So no one will be able to understand you. It'll be great.
Right.
By the way.
I'll put a CPAP machine on and breathe like Darth Vader the whole time. It'll be great.
At Ignite will be Lou Maresca, who is one of my co-hosts for This Week in Enterprise Tech. So please take care of him. He's a good guy. And he doesn't normally, he didn't used to be able to go to these conferences, but he's been moved up in the Microsoft hierarchy, and now he gets to go and represent the company, although he's not sure how much time he needs to spend as a booth rep. So we'll see.
Yeah, we're going to go find him.
A booth babe.
A booth babe.
We say.
That's, yes. I said that last time. I got in trouble, but you said it this time, so it's fine.
Yeah, I'm just a politically correct nightmare waiting to happen. So,
Paul, Mary Jo, this has been an absolute honor. I love doing this show with you. I love talking Windows. It's the world in which I spend most of my digital life. So, hey, you know, this is always a good thing. Paul, what are you up to? What should people know about what you're writing, about the projects you're doing, about where you'll be heading up to? Where can they find Paul Thurrott on the internet?
Well, at the creatively named Thurrott.com and at Thurrott on Twitter. I've been updating the Windows 10 book for the Fall Creators Update, so there should be new content every week. But, I mean, you know, I'll probably post at least a couple of new chapters this week. So that's at leanpub.com.
Paul Thurrott of Thurrott.com. Again, you need to stop by to see his insights into the world of Windows. Like, for example, that the new Xbox will be the best ever, and you need to go play Cuphead. Speaking of Cuphead, Mary Jo Foley, aside from your busy Cuphead schedule, where can they find you?
I'm always on allaboutmicrosoft.com, on Twitter at Mary Jo Foley, and next week we'll be everywhere at Microsoft Ignite.
Yep.
Well, fantastic. That's going to be busy. Will you be live streaming any of that aside from the show?
So can we say what we're doing, or how do we?
I just got my schedule and it's not on there, so I think we shouldn't say yet, but Paul and I may make some other appearances at the show. Sorry for the sirens.
I was gonna say, that one's not me.
Yeah. But we can't really, I don't think we can say right now, but we may be part.
Well, we're doing a show from the show. We're doing Windows Weekly from there.
Yep.
And Brad and I are doing First Ring Daily on Monday and Tuesday from the show as well.
Yep. Fantastic. Maybe you could do it for the Microsoft booth. I know a guy working in the Microsoft booth. He might be able to hook you up.
I think there's seriously, like 2 hours and 14 minutes into a 2 hour and 15 minute podcast, I got away with no Brad Sims. So I think your cat just walked in front of the webcam. Is that what just happened?
That's
amazing.
I have another meeting I have to jump off to. He's warning me.
There's a good chance you'll see Mary Jo and I at least on some on some stuff.
I think you'll see us.
Paul, Mary Jo, thanks again. And thanks to you. Don't forget that you can catch the show live on Wednesdays at 11 o'clock a.m. Pacific, or watch it on demand at live.twit.tv. Also, you could find it at its show page at twit.tv/ww, where you can find all the back episodes as well as a place to subscribe. And as long as you're going to watch it live, why not jump into our chat room at irc.twit.tv and see what the Twit Army has to say about the world of Microsoft. Until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballister, the digital Jesuit, in for Leo Laporte, reminding you to have a great day and be sure to take your Windows Weekly.